So tonight's main reading is from Matthew chapter 25, which can be found on page 994 of the Pew Bibles. Page 994, Matthew 25, beginning to read at verse 14. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." The man with the 2 talents also came. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. "Master," he said, "I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you." His master replied, "You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown, and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." This is the word of the Lord.
Good. Well, I want to share 3 Christian principles that are derived from the Bible, have been tested out in history and in personal Christian lives, which I think give wisdom in both personal and household economics at any time, but particularly in a time that is economically challenging. I've just realized that as I was sitting there that the word economics must be derived from the word for household, because household in Greek is oikonomos. And, of course, all of the businesses in that particular period of time would have been predominantly family ones, certainly extended family ones. Well, that's as it may be. But anyway, we'll cover our attitude to work, our attitude to wealth, the core moral requirement, and the need for restraint on consumption, and then with some practical applications. So the 3 principles are these. They're at the bottom of the notes on here. We're here to make the very best use of the world that God has given us, so we can provide for all those who we have a duty towards. Secondly, we're to be honest so we can trade. And thirdly, we are to save so we can invest to create more wealth and a better future. So let's take them in turn, and then we'll actually try and apply them to some everyday issues. So we're to make the very best use of the world that God has given us, so we can provide for those who are born. Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our own image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and all the creatures which move along the ground." So God created man in his own image, in the image of God who created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, and this is the key bit, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it." So we're basically here to multiply, that's to have more human beings, and to manage the earth as God's stewards on his behalf. And even after the fall, when everything went wrong, that was still to be the case, although both managing the world and having babies took a little bit more sweat, apparently. I can't imagine childbirth could have ever been without some degree of discomfort, but it was apparently aggravated as a result of the fall. And certainly work is toil sometimes now, rather than a pleasure. And even after the flood, God restated his purpose as being to multiply and manage. So Genesis 9:1, then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number." And they were to cultivate. Such a view prevailed throughout the whole of the Old Testament period. You see it in Psalm 8, for example. In verse 6, "You made him," that's man, "ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet." So we are his managing stewards. And of course, the parable of the talent, which we've just had read to us, urges us to personally make the very best use of the God-given abilities that we have in this life. Now, we've been very good at multiplying. I think in my lifetime, the population of the world has increased by 2 billion. I think it's about 7 billion now. However, we've not been quite so good at actually managing the world. Now, our God is green. Not that I think you'd find him in the Green Party, but he is green. He is the God of conservation. We have to remember that we're managers in the sense that we are stewards of God's creation, managing it on his behalf. And so each generation shouldn't take out more than it puts in. We should leave the world with a certain amount of value addedness. We shouldn't deprive the next generation by using all the resources in this one, which means that if, for example, we use up all the coal and oil, we have to discover other ways of generating energy so that our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren are not worse off than we were. So what's the solution? How do we actually achieve that? Well, there would seem to me to be three that fly around. First is just stop all economic development now. That's how to be conservationist. But that would be incredibly hard on the less developed world, because while we're staying at the level that we currently enjoy, they'd have no chance of reaching it. Not only would that be unfair, it's completely unrealistic. Secondly, we could decide to stop further development and redistribute all that we currently have, somehow get the United Nations to go communist overnight, and we just all redistribute everything so everybody in the whole world can have the same amount of money. Well, we tried communism, and according to the French newspaper Le Figaro, the human cost in communism was 165 million lives lost in the former Soviet Union and communist China, because to achieve things like that requires a vicious totalitarianism, which is incredibly cruel and rides roughshod over people and regards them as just commodities. So that leads us with a third option, that we must improve the productivity of the Earth's natural resources. For example, we must find new sources of energy to replace what we've used and to use that energy more efficiently. So, take the boiler that we have at home. We've had it about 3 years, and it now uses about a third to a half of the amount of gas that the previous one did. Or take the discovery of how to extract aluminium from bauxite. Aluminium has a productive coating which minimizes corrosion. It gives far longer life than steel and is therefore much less wasteful. A large proportion of aluminium production is collected as scrap, re-smelted and used again. It's easier to reuse than either steel or plastic. It's much lighter in vehicles than either wood or steel, and so it gives large savings in scarce fuel supplies. Most aluminium smelters are located in areas where they have hydroelectric power, where the water was previously just running to waste, being not terribly useful. And since the Second World War, the expansion of the world's aluminium industry has probably contributed to the conservation of resources, even though there is, of course, a fraction less bauxite left in the ground than there was 70 years ago. Now, that is innovation. Somebody used their minds to understand how that ore could be used in the way it now so commonly is. They did that. They used their minds, and then people have then managed to put that knowledge into practical application. And there are many more examples, aren't there? Think of Dutch civil engineers reclaiming vast areas of the sea. Think of the Italians who tapped into the tremendous hydroelectric power that there is in the Alps. Think about how all around the world, particularly in the 1930s, huge dams were constructed, which help previously desert areas to blossom and flourish agriculturally. Think similarly of roads that were driven into inaccessible regions of the world to help bring those areas into cultivation. And what about the future? Imagine if today, in our generation, somebody can work out how very cheaply and, of course, energy efficiently, if they could work out how to extract hydrogen from water, because hydrogen burns, and it would be an answer to the fuel needs of the world for centuries. Or what if somebody could find a cheap and energy-efficient way of turning salt water into fresh water? Imagine how you could transform Saudi Arabia, how it could start growing food. You see, God has given us a fantastic world full of resources, and he's also given us brains so that we can try and understand nature and tap into those resources. So that's the first thing you have to have. You have to have this mindset. Many cultures are fatalistic. I've seen in some Muslim countries where they just walk across the road. They don't bother to look, because if Allah wills them to get run over, then they get run over. So what's the point of looking? I mean, that is incredible fatalism. No, we're here to actually think God's thoughts after him and to be innovative and enterprising and to make the very best use without misusing the world. So that's the first thing, that kind of attitude, that you can do better than the previous generation. The second one is to have honesty so you can trade. Honesty is absolutely vital. Think about getting your car repaired. And when you take it to the garage, you are trusting that they will make an accurate diagnosis of the fault and that they will repair it economically. You don't want them to do more than is necessary and so cost you more. You don't want them to do less than is necessary so that you pay for what turns out to be a worthless repair. So you have to trust them. But they also have to trust you, because they don't charge up front in advance. What they'll do is they'll put in a number of hours of labour and they'll purchase the spare parts necessary to repair your car, and they do all that before you pay a penny to them. They are trusting that you are both willing and able to pay them. Now, if they're not competent in doing the repair, or if they charge you for work that's not been done and you discover it, you're never going to use them again. And similarly, if they do the work and you don't pay, how will they respond next time that you've got an emergency with your car? They're certainly not going to help you out, are they? You see, the whole trading system requires trust. And without trust, the whole thing grinds to a halt. And the third thing, which you can see in countries which are riddled with corruption from top to bottom. And thirdly, you have to be prepared to limit your consumption. So when you receive wealth, money, you don't spend it all at once. What you do is you save some so that you can invest and you can create more. That's the third thing that's necessary, both in personal and in public economics. And a successful business life is to save so that you can invest. Don't consume everything that you earn or produce immediately. You keep some back so that you can grow and develop your business. So, for example, imagine that you're manufacturing spectacles. You save some money up from your sales so that you can buy a new piece of equipment that will enable you to make the lenses far more cheaply, better and quicker. And then you'll be able to make even more money from your sales because you'll sell them cheaper and attract more customers. And that'll pay off your, that'll pay you richly for having done that. You are multiplying your literal talents. And that's for the benefit of both you, your employees, and your customers. And if you've borrowed the money, of course, you're the people who've lent it to you. So, to summarize those three principles, we have a purpose. God has placed us here to multiply and to manage his earth to the very best of our ability. We are to be honest so that we can trade. We all benefit from specialization. Rather than all of us trying to fix our own cars or cutting our own hair, we do something that we're good at and people want and will pay for, so that someone who is better and quicker at it, car mechanics in my case, and hairdressing in my case, can do it. And we all benefit. But it needs trust and honesty in order for it to work. And thirdly, save and invest to develop and expand. So let's see how some of those might be applied in our daily living. So, innovation and wealth creation. Ecclesiastes 9:10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. We've only got one life. There comes a point, and it's usually better arrived at earlier rather than later, when you have to decide what you're going to do with that life. God has given us a planet full of resources and has given us good brains and good hands to use. We should use them to the full, discover these resources, apply them for everyone's benefit. And clearly we should do this with our whole heart. So, drifting through life, not thinking where on earth you're going, is a pretty hopeless and unchristian attitude. So if somebody asks you, what are you hoping to do? The reply, I don't know, is not actually very Christian. We should at least have thought about some possibilities, even in the broadest sense, so that we have some sense of direction in life, that we've got a grip on things. We do need a high level of self-discipline and motivation. We need to set high standards for ourselves. So if we find ourselves slipping, we need to recognize and correct those things. Because if we don't get a grip over what we're doing, and then a crisis comes along, and we find it difficult to cope, and we grow weary, and we worry, and we get emotionally depleted. Whereas it is incredibly energizing to be able to do something with competence. Now, while many of us find CPD, continuing professional development, something of a pain, we do have a duty to develop our skills and talents throughout our lives. Secondly, another thing that we can learn, thinking about this whole creation innovation thing, is that no one owes you a living. we have to take responsibility for our own lives. 1 Thessalonians 4:11. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business and to work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders and so that you will not be dependent on anybody. We should provide for our families, 2 Corinthians 12:14. Now I am ready to visit you for the third time, and I will not burden you, because what I want is not your possessions, but you. After all, and this is the point, children should not have to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. But lest you don't think you should look after your elderly parents. 1 Timothy 5:8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So you take my generation. We got our university education for free. We had our tuition fees paid. I don't think we were even aware that there were such things. I think the government just took care of that. We were given a grant by the local education authority to cover our board and lodging. And the grants, in fact, were quite generous. I mean, I can think I saved enough money at the end of university to buy myself a Mark 1 Ford Escort, white, SYN558N, I can remember. I can't remember my current car number, but I can remember that one. And the parental contribution was quite low, and I came from, you know, quite a poor family, and so I think my parents contributed less than £100 a year, which was probably something like about 10% of the board and lodging costs. I can't remember, maybe less than that, really. And it seems to me, though, that since our generation got it for free, then we should curtail some of our personal consumption in order to support as best we can our children who face crippling amounts of debt in order to go to university. Paul is also against people being idle when they're able to work. So 3:6, keep away from every brother who is idle and does not live according to the teaching you received from us. We gave you this rule, if a man will not work, he shall not eat. Such people we command in the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the bread that they eat. Now the emphasis is on being able to work. There's a very strong line of teaching in the Bible that we have a duty to particularly take care of the widow, the orphan, and the alien in our midst. We're talking about those who, through no fault of their own, are particularly poor and destitute. We're not talking about economic migrants, but we are talking about people who face severe persecution or even death in their own country. So there's some application to the whole innovation, wealth creation, making the best use of the world and of our lives in it. Some application for honesty in order to trade, expanding on what we've already said. One other suggestion, pay on time. If you get a plumber to fix your leaking system, then do pay on the day that you receive his invoice, because he's probably a one-man band, and he needs to eat that week. And so it's rather good if he gets paid as close as possible to when he actually did the job. If you pay up promptly, then when you have a flood and you need him to fix it immediately, then he's far more likely to turn out if you're a good payer than if you're not. Honesty pays. And then the third principle, save to invest. And this raises the interesting question of interest rates. In the Old Testament, charging interest for lending to other members of the people of God was in fact forbidden. Now, to my mind, that means that within families, we should be prepared to lend money at 0% interest to help others out. We get our money back, saves them having to sort of pay interest on a loan. But what does it mean outside of the family? Should we put our capital in a savings account to earn interest? Should we borrow money and pay interest? Well, remember, we're operating outside of the people of God when we're doing that. And it would seem to me perfectly reasonable to place our money in a building society, like a mutual one, like, say, the Nationwide, which is owned by its members, who are the people who deposit in it and borrow from it. Because what you're doing is you are getting a modest return upon your capital. You're making it work. You're enabling people to buy a house at a lower rate of interest than they might otherwise have to pay. The building society charges them a higher rate of interest than it pays you, and it uses the difference to cover their running costs. Again, it's another situation where everybody is potentially a winner. I mean, if you owned a company and you wanted to expand, it would be in order for you to borrow capital, because if you bought that extra piece of machinery, you could actually make goods cheaper, better, and quicker. And providing you can foresee that that will result in increased income that can cover the cost of that loan, well, then go for it. But what about borrowing as an individual? Well, I would say it's better avoided if possible. Now, having said that, just about everybody has to borrow money in order to buy a house, and just about everybody has to borrow money in order to go to university. But for all other things, it is probably best avoided. I suppose you could make out a case for buying an old banger if that enabled you to do a job that required you to somehow get there, and without the car, you wouldn't be able to do the job. But there probably aren't many more exceptions than that. And one reason why is because it's so jolly expensive. And this is where maths lessons are really quite useful to have paid attention in. So take, for example, a personal loan from a building society at 8% APR. That's the annual rate of interest. Over 5 years, there's an arrangement fee of 100 quid. That's for filling in a form. And then there's interest on the £5,000 plus £100 times 8% times 5 years gives you £2,040. So the total is going to be the fee plus the interest to give you £2,140 plus paying the principal back. So borrowing £5,000 is going to you're going to have to pay back £7,140. Think about it. What about the next one? What about a credit card? Here, 30% APR, some of them are. That means that in a year, if you borrow £1,000, you've got to pay £300 back in interest. Or what about these, Wonga.com? You see, they're good little adverts, very nasty sort of outfit, I would say. Imagine, just an example. This is one I just gleaned a couple of days ago, real-life example. Susan, she gets about... I don't know who this Susan is, by the way. I just read it out of a newspaper. Susan gets around £600 a month in benefits. And recently, when she was struggling to pay back a large overdue bill, she took out £400 with Wonga. That's right, for 30 days. I'll come back to that. Is that the right one? She was struggling to pay back a large overdue bill. She took out £400 with Wonga. She can't remember the term, but if she kept it for a month, Wonga would have charged her £130 for the service. That's £61 a fortnight. A huge extra chunk out of the £600, remember, she has to live on. Now, what's actually happening, I think? So she borrows 400 quid for 30 days. The charges and interest are £130. She pays back £530. So given that her monthly income is £600, 25% of the next month's income goes in paying Wonga. No wonder the guys who founded it have made about 50 million quid each. These payday loans really cost a fortune. Here are some of the different APRs used by some of the ones that appear on telly. They have interest rates of 1,734, or Wonga's, their representative rate on their website is 4,212%. Imagine what happens if you can't pay after 30 days. The best thing about these are to avoid them. You know, don't go into debt other than borrowing for mortgages or student loans, because it's much better rather than borrow and buy, it's much better to save and spend. Because after all, there comes a point where borrowing money is wanting something before we can afford it. And that isn't that getting perilously close to greed? And isn't greed generated by covetousness? So it's probably worth ending by having a look at the rich and the poor and covetousness. So Paul in 1 Timothy 6, he has words to the Christian poor, to the contented poor, first of all. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Of course, in our climate and economy, we need a bit more than food, more than just food and clothing. But the point is, we need enough to basically live and to meet our obligations. Well, then there's the covetous poor. He says, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. And then he turns from addressing the poor to addressing the rich. We're left to decide whether we're poor or rich. So there are the dangers of being rich, which are pride and materialism. Command those, he says, who are rich in this present world, not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. And then there are the duties of being rich, to be rich in good deeds. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. Which he doesn't mean old age, he means heaven. So that they may take hold of life that is truly life. So, as I end, a little sort of summary. A bit of Christian wisdom in living out our economic life, personal life. Make the very best use of your God-given talent. Be honest. Save and invest rather than borrow and buy. Fulfill your obligations to your family, and don't let riches replace God. Well, now Nick tells me I'm supposed to answer questions, but...